All right, let's get ready for class. You all are ready. I'm not ready. Could I get a volunteer? Yeah, just hand those out. It may not be that everyone gets one, but this is one for at least households. So don't take one if you don't want one. You don't have to take one. But this is the schedule for the upcoming Psalm study. About a year ago, we went through book one of the Psalms. Was it a year ago? Or was it 2 years ago? Some time ago, in the not so far distant past, we went through book one of the Psalms. So now we're going through book two of the Psalms, and this is going to be divided up through various men who will be leading that discussion. Justin Lynch and I will be upstairs with the intermediate class teaching all of them. So there you go. The various classes will be led by different men. With one interruption with the GROW conference. Otherwise, we'll be just following along. Can I have one real quick? Thank you, sir. What I'll ask you to do for this, because each man can certainly send out study questions, a study guide ahead of time if they want to. It'd be great if you did that. But if they don't, that's fine. I've just included some questions here at the end of this. And these are questions that we looked at last time, just to kind of get us all grease the gears, if you will, for our discussion. Does that make sense? Greasing the gears? Did they say that in India? I don't know, grease the gears. But preparing for the discussion, okay? So what's the story? In other words, is there a background historical note for this psalm or not? Even if there's not, can we find some kind of progression to the themes in this psalm? What are the pictures? In other words, what are the figures of speech, the imagery? Poetry is evocative. It's figurative. That's the whole thing that makes poetry what it is. And then asking you to look carefully at the structure. So parallelism, everyone remember what a chiasm is? If you don't, that's fine. You can look it up or ask me later or ask someone else. But chiasms are fun. Some people find chiasms where there aren't or find them everywhere. That's fine. I'm probably more in the camp of they're everywhere. But just the idea that there's a structure and therefore it pinpoints a meaning. So you'll look for those structural points. And then the last three questions, 4, 5, and 6, I'm especially interested in, is how do we hear this from the voice of David or Asaph or whoever it may be, and how does this connect with them, thinking about their experience? How does it connect to Jesus? Again, the Law of the Prophets and the Psalms find their fulfillment in Jesus. So how can I hear the story of Jesus through this psalm? Or maybe even a contrast to Jesus, right? And then finally, how should we use this ourselves individually and as a church? So looking forward to this. I wish I could be down here with you, but I'm sure you wish you could be upstairs with the kids, because I'm looking forward to how they discover these psalms. Kids are great at poetry. I think as adults, we get embarrassed to talk about poetry, and as kids, they're like, what does this mean? It's like, it's a great question. It's just a great question. All right, thoughts, questions about this? Yes? No? Okay, all right. Then let's start our class in Esther, chapter 9. With a prayer, please. Micah, would you mind praying for us?
Let's bow. Our great God, we thank you for your word. We thank you for this opportunity we have to open it together. And our prayer to you is that we would do so with honest and receptive hearts, eager to know more about your truth that you've so graciously revealed to us, and ready to change our lives as needed to better match what you want from us. Be with Justin as he leads our thoughts. Be with us as we study, if it's your will. May your blessing be on us now. In Jesus' name, amen.
Okay, thank you, sir. So getting us up to speed here with Esther. Esther, remember, is the relative of Mordecai. Her Hebrew name is Hadassah. Esther probably refers to Ishtar. Mordecai probably refers to Marduk, and so there's some Babylonian identity going on here. But Esther is now the queen of Persia. How did that happen?
Beauty contest.
It's a beauty contest, essentially. That's right. Yeah, great. And a very lengthy one at that. They spent a long time getting all sorts of beauty treatments. We think they're beautiful now, but I think about all the treatments they experienced. And okay. And so why did they have this particular beauty contest? Yes, unhappy, very mild way of saying it. Like he basically banishes the queen Vashti, right? Because she would not listen to the king, would not obey the king, and so he has this whole crisis about how, what are we going to do here? My wife won't obey me, and the servants are going, well, if they don't, she won't obey him, our wives won't obey us. And so they make this law, they make this commandment. So Esther is taken in to be queen. Meanwhile, we meet the real antagonist, I think was the word that was used earlier today, Sanballat and Tobiah, the antagonist in Nehemiah. We meet the antagonist in the book of Esther. His name is Haman or Haman. Are we decided? Have we voted on Haman or Haman? But this guy, he is, what's the problem with this person? He doesn't like Mordecai because Mordecai won't bow down to him. And we're kind of on the fence about why he won't bow down to him. It may be that too much honor is almost like worshiping Haman. Or just the fact that he's an Agagite, which is probably a reference to Saul with the Amalekites and that failure to destroy the Amalekites. King Agag was initially spared and then not spared, but maybe the descendants of that. Seems to be the case. But Mordecai is not going to bow down to Haman. Haman hates Mordecai, decides to destroy the Jews. How does he determine when to destroy the Jews? Yeah, he casts lots, the Purim, right? And so they determine... God determines, really, God's the one who's over all this, basically gives the people as long as possible to handle all this. Then, of course, Mordecai sees the decree, there's confusion and chaos in all of the empire, certainly all of Susa, while Haman and his buddy Ahasuerus, the king, are doing what? They're drinking. Yeah, they're celebrating, they're partying, they're drinking. It's another feast, while the people are all in a panic. Okay, and then Mordecai sends word to Esther. Esther goes into the king, and she uses two feasts to persuade the king that he should listen to her and give her favor. And so when he finds out that someone is going to kill her and kill all of her people, who is it? She says, Haman. And what does the king do? Yeah, he leaves the room. Now, side bit, and this is pretty important to the story. What has Haman just done for the king and for the one who saved the life of the king? Like earlier that day, what did Haman do?
He had to do honor to the one that the king wanted to honor.
Right, and he wants
thought
to,
it was him.
Right? Yeah, he thought it was himself, but it was Mordecai. What? Mordecai, the same one that Haman wants to kill? Yes. Why does he want to honor Mordecai? Because Mordecai saved his life. Okay, so now Haman wants to kill not only Esther, but all of Esther's people, including Mordecai, the same person who just saved the king's life. And so the king's mad, doesn't know what to do, steps out, and he comes back in, and he finds that Haman has fallen over Esther trying to plead for his life. Okay. We're rushing through the story here, but we're getting up to speed. So what does he have done to Haman? Yeah, he's executed, right? He covers his face, takes him out, has him executed. He's hanged on, the ESV says, the gallows that were prepared for him, chapter 7, verse 8. And now we've got this problem because there's a law in place that spells destruction for the Jews. Can't undo the law. That's the law of the Medes and the Persians. We talked last time about how that might not be a good thing, but it also might be a good thing. I don't know if we talked much about it being a positive thing. Why might it be a positive thing? Benefits to having laws that can't be repealed. Yeah, you're less likely just to spur the moment spontaneously decree something, hopefully, right? Because this thing is going to be in place forever. So being thoughtful about the rules and restrictions that are given. So you can't undo that. So what do they do instead? Yeah, so they make a new law that the Jews can defend themselves. The Jews can go forward and attack their enemies who are going to attack them, and they can plunder their enemies, and that's the rule given in chapter 8. And so, as a result of this new law, in chapter 8, verse 16, the Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. Okay, and at the end of chapter 8, many from the peoples of the country declare themselves Jews, for fear the Jews had fallen on them. And so now they're celebrating, instead of all the confusion, their celebration, okay? Anything I've left off, your thoughts, questions through chapter 8?
Well,
It's all clicking along. All right, chapter 9 and 10 is really just tying things up neatly in a bow here. So in the 12th month, the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. So I asked you question 1 to explain the outcome of the Jews' deliverance from their enemies in Esther 9 and 10. So what does this look like for the Jews to find comfort and victory in this new law? Men?
The Jews gathered together to fight back and were terrifying. So they slaughtered the people that were against them.
Okay. And Meredith?
They got to jump ahead a little bit, but like they learned from past mistakes about how they're supposed to battle, they leave the plunder. Like you don't touch it.
Great.
And so that's showing a change of heart that they have learned from past mistakes, and so God is
Yeah, I think it's interesting. The law actually provided for them to plunder their enemies. So Meredith is making the case, and I think it's very worth considering, that the Jews decided not to plunder their enemies. So what past mistakes might you be thinking of?
When God told them to defeat the Canaanites, defeat them and leave nothing.
Right.
Instead, they left something. Like they always left something for themselves or left something or took things for themselves.
On occasion, God would say, like with Ai, he'll say, go in, you get the plunder. But oftentimes he'll say, go in and destroy man, woman, child, livestock, burn the city down, everything gets destroyed, like in Jericho. And you've got Achan who takes. Specific to this story, do you remember what God told Saul through Samuel the prophet about the Amalekites?
Destroy them all. Like, destroy everybody, leave nothing, and he kept Agag alive.
Right. Saul comes back and he says, Samuel, I have obeyed the Lord. And as he comes back saying, I've obeyed the Lord, back here, and I hear sheep and cattle and oxen. And he's like, well, that's sacrifice, right? And who is this? Well, this is King Agag. And I thought you destroyed them all. So I think probably what this is a fulfillment. You know, finally, you get the Amalekites destroyed. Because not only do they kill, they destroy enemies. How many was it? Was it 500? And then they also destroyed who else? What was that, Lee?
Well, she said the Palestinians destroyed 500.
Yes.
You want me to go through these names? You
know, no. I won't ask you for the names, but the names are identified as who?
The 10 sons of Agag.
Ah, so maybe Agagites, right? Amalekites. So you maybe see a completion of this. I'm not for sure about that. But it is interesting. I think it does go back to the people learn from those mistakes. So they get to fulfill. How long has it been? It's been hundreds and hundreds of years since God has said, do this thing. And it's like God saying, it's not too late. You can do this thing. That's encouraging. That's exciting. What else do you notice about the way they get victory in this, on this occasion?
I remember you talking a couple weeks ago about how ironic, like, there were a lot of things that were turning on their heads, and like there was a lot of irony. And I'm seeing that again. Like there had been a plan for the Persians to conquer and kill the Jews, but then it also happens the Jews conquered them.
Yes.
The Persians that hated them.
Yes. Yeah, and all the fear that they must have been living under, and now because of the new law, they have courage. They have joy. Gladness and honor. So yeah, all this is being upended. What else did you notice? Make another case, if you would, for why they don't plunder the people. What else that might indicate, Noah?
Well, I don't know if this is a reason, but I think it may have caused the people they were among, the Jews, to the people that they were subject to, to probably look at them in a different and more favorable light to say, hey, they could have really done a job on us, and they didn't, and maybe we should change our attitude towards them.
I think that's right, is the Jews are not in this to get rich. They're not robbing these people. Okay? They're not murdering just to take stuff. They're defending themselves according to the law. And so this is saying something about the character of the Jews. April?
Yeah, just on that same note, it specifies that who the Jews attack were their enemies. this day and take their stuff, it would be really easy to see that being abused. But they
right.
only attack their enemies,
right.
the ones who are going to be coming after them, and they don't take the stuff. And so it helps make clear what is being accomplished by this as opposed to being an abuse.
Yes, 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 yes. Lynn?
Well, I'm just tying it back to chapter 3, where Mon has the proclamation to the king of, like, it is not your profit for these people to live. But the argument Esther makes in chapter 7 is, like, we don't want to be annihilated.
We'd be happy to be your slaves.
If we had just been
yeah.
your slaves, I wouldn't have said a word. So the way that they're responding is backing up Esther's claim, not Mon's claim.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right, now we get to verse 20, unless there's something else. Oh, there was one more thing, wasn't there? Yes, there was. One other thing that happens with this defeat of the enemy. Basically, they say, hey, this was great. Can we do it again tomorrow? So yeah, I'll do it again tomorrow. So they go through and they get to do it over again because some people were left. If you were an enemy of the Jews, like you just decided Haman's right, hate those pesky Jews, hate them, and then you find out this new law, you're going to hide, and then maybe you make it out that day. Whew, okay, I survived that day. They can't get me tomorrow. Are you kidding me? There's another law. They get to come at me again. Yeah, God is just sweeping it clean. He's really providing for his people here. And so in verse 16, the rest of the Jews who are in the king's provinces gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000. And so this is exactly what Esther was pleading for on behalf of her people. Now, in verse 20, the Jews determined to keep this memorial, and Esther and Mordecai send out word about this memorial. How does this celebration work? This is called Purim, named for the lots that are cast, which is interesting. Why would you do that, Meredith?
It feels like another moment of irony that it went from what Haman did, part of
yes.
his plot, and now they're taking it as we're remembering what happened and that they were ultimately saved from that plot.
The darkest day was turned into a day of deliverance. Does that remind you of anything? I mean, come on.
3 days in the ground.
Yeah. I mean, Genesis 3, right? He shall bruise your
head.
Yeah. And he shall bruise his heel. So what looks like defeat is turned around into victory. And so I think, yeah, so it's a wonderful thing. To, you know, it's almost in mockery of the enemy that they planned and plotted to destroy us, and God used their plots to undo them. Okay. That's just like something God would do. Okay. So this day of celebration, what are some of the things that you see them doing on the two days of Purim? Okay, so they're sharing wealth. What might that put them in memory of? Did you connect it at all with the events of the day? It's a day of gift giving. Okay, taking care of the poor. I wonder if it has to do with the plunder. I don't know. It's just like we're not laying hands on the plunder. We're not grabbing for ourselves. And here they're giving things away. I wonder if it connects in that way. But this is put in memory of that. What else? It's a day of, what was that? Feasting. Which, again, a little bit of irony there for those that like that sort of thing, is who's doing all the feasting in this book? Ahasuerus and his nobles. And then the people get a few days of feasting. But now, like, the Jews get to feast. So the people who were down, people who were going to be defeated, are the ones who get to celebrate. And it's commanded that they should celebrate. And so this month had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, from mourning into a holiday. Make them days of feasting and gladness. So just think practically here. I think this is a really useful thing to do. Obviously, today we have a memorial. We have the Lord's Supper, where God took a day of great defeat and turned it into deliverance. And you ever thought much about why we take the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week? It's when he's raised. Right? The Bible doesn't clarify that, but I mean, it seems like that seems to be the focus here. But what are we remembering on the first day of the week?
Remember Jesus' victory over death.
remembering, go ahead. We're remembering Jesus' body and blood. We're remembering his death on the day that he's raised. Do you see how that's a little ironic? So it's the day that we're really thinking about his death, but we're celebrating on the day that he's raised from the dead, and we're thinking about his return. He says, you do this until I come. So all that is compounded in this day of remembrance. It's a very complex kind of memorial. So very similar, like, okay, this is the day where our enemies were going to get us. And for the Lord's Supper, did he get Jesus? Yeah, he got him. But this is also the day that we're going to celebrate that God delivered us, and that's exactly what happened with Jesus in the tomb and the resurrection. So all that's taking place there. But can you think of other occasions where we might want to feast, we might want to celebrate, things like that for Christians today? Maybe not like worldwide. I'm just thinking like individually, personally, things we might want to celebrate. That's wonderful. Yeah, I like that a lot. We've got it on our family calendar of Elijah's and Lyndon's and Amos's new birthdays. And so it pops up on our calendar, and we should probably make a cake or something. I don't know. Always looking for an excuse for dessert. But something to celebrate that. Okay? What other occasions do you think to celebrate, to feast? I'm not looking for excuses for potlucks, by the way, but I'll take them. What are some good reasons? I knew of a church where a brother had been disfellowshipped and for years had been away and very public. And when he returned, they held a potluck. And I think that's just so appropriate. we will pray for him and we'll go up and give him hugs. But no, the elders got together and they said, usually you don't leave it to the elders to schedule stuff like that, but the elders said, no, we're going to celebrate this brother coming back, which reminds us of Luke 15. Kill the fatted calf. My son who was dead is now alive, put a ring on his finger, put sandals on his feet, and that's a beautiful thing. As a family, we had a moment where one of Lindsay's brothers, and it ended up being two brothers, who had been wayward, and they came back, and we all came as a family, drove hours to come and welcome them back in. And it was a moment of very, I don't want to say severe, but serious conversations. There was a lot of confession, a lot of grieving, a lot of hugging. It was very specific around the room. And then we ate and we drank. And there was that celebration. So I think this is an appropriate thing for us to express those kinds of things. And maybe, I don't know, in our Western American society, maybe we're too contained, think, well, being godly and spirit. Like, shout. Shout for the Lord and rejoice in those things. We should. Lee?
There's joy in heaven.
Yes.
Return, so why wouldn't there be joy in feasting and festival?
So there's joy in heaven and we're going, yes, thank you.
Exactly.
Just very, yes. Okay. We're not trying to womp up artificial emotions, but it is an appropriate time to celebrate.
There's one congregation that celebrate marriages, and the whole congregation get together. They pray for the couple and everything, and celebrate birth of new children, and pray for the future of these children.
Yeah,
I think that was pretty cool.
Yeah. All right. So lots of things to celebrate. We're not trying to nail anything down like what they were doing here. It's like you've got to do this, but it is still helpful for us to think about the place that memorials have in encouraging people toward godliness. And you see that throughout the entire Old Covenant. The reason they took the Passover, the reason they took Feast of Booths, the reason they did all these things to set up the 12 stones, is so they'd have something to tell their children. This is what God has done for us, don't you forget. Because why were they in captivity in the first place? They forgot. They didn't remember. Okay, now, Book of Esther ends with this reference to Ahasuerus. This is not how I would have chosen to end the book. I mean, it's called Esther, for crying out loud. But now we're going to talk about Ahasuerus and Mordecai. And so in chapter 10, it talks about the greatness of Ahasuerus, his power, his might, his high honor, the high honor of Mordecai, which the king advanced him. He's second in rank to King Ahasuerus, which is very much like two other characters in the Bible we see, very much like Joseph and Daniel. Mordecai shares some interesting similarities between Moses and Daniel. Esther does too in some way. Don't let anybody know who you are. There's some of that going on. But he's now second rank in the kingdom, and he grows popular. So what conclusions would you make of that? Why the book ends this way?
I'm not going to answer that question, but just along the lines of connections, which one little thing that was pointed out to me recently, when Mordecai's refusing to bow down, and it says day after day, they
yes.
tried to get
right. Potiphar's wife, you know, coming after him again and again and again. So, yes, exactly right. Yes. No.
All the different times when in the New Testament it talks about that he takes the proud and makes them humble, and he takes the humble and makes them great.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, just the attitudes, you know.
Yes.
That type of idea that this is the system that God works on.
Right.
It's very different than the system the world works on.
Yeah. Here's another... another indicator in the Bible of how God performs these reversals. And so if I want greatness, I want honor, then I need to choose humility, I need to choose servitude, self-sacrifice, and trust that God will turn that around. Meredith?
This is not connected, but...
I love how you people want to raise your hand and not...
Go ahead. like the Book of Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia, like is there copies of that anywhere? Like,
the one thing that I know of, and I think we've mentioned it before, is the Cyrus Cylinder, which isn't even really about Jerusalem, but it is about Cyrus commanding peoples to go back home and rebuild their temples. But as far as what this is referring to, I don't know. But it is neat, because the Bible's not afraid to say, hey, check your sources.
Right, like, that's what they mean. Just think, like, why would it end this way and not to be like a...
follow the whole story and you get to the end, and typically if you've been dealing with a bunch of characters, the author, even if it's not the main character, like they summarize the main storyline and then there's like a little blurb like, and someone's up with this, and someone's up with this. Like that's a typical way, because the book started with these people.
Yeah.
Like the book started with the king and fleshing out who he was, and it was not a great picture. And Mordecai is actually introduced right along with that. So it's almost like, like, let's make sure you understand how the story began. Let's wrap it up here at the end and revisit where they ended up.
Honestly, it reminds me a bit of Ruth, where Ruth is obviously the main character of her book, but you want to know what happens to Naomi. You want to know what happens to Boaz. And by the end, Naomi is blessed by the people for having such a great, you know, daughter-in-law. And then Boaz, and then Obed, and then David, and you see that this is what Ruth does, helps so many people and brings so many people honor and glory. And I think the same thing is said of Esther, is because of what she has done, the Jews in the kingdom are spared, Ahasuerus is honored, Mordecai is honored, so there's great impact for people doing what's right.
It also seems to really put the nail in the coffin of, remember how in the beginning of the book the king was trying to show this power and greatness and pomp and all, and he really wasn't. And then here we have, look what God did in raising Mordecai.
Yes.
And now there is actually good stuff happening.
Yeah, as far as like why it doesn't end with Esther, the point of the book is not what happens to Esther.
Right.
The point of the book is what God is accomplishing. But it's not coming out and saying God,
Yes, and I want to, on that, spend the last bit of our time here, not looking at this, looking at this. Because I want to get to that point specifically. Let's look carefully here at shadows of Christ. How is Esther a shadow of Christ? She saved the people. I think we kind of addressed that in the Lord's Supper, right? She lays her life on the line for the salvation of her people. If I perish, I perish. Anything else you see about Esther kind of being a shadow of Christ?
Third day. On the third day, she finds
myself. Oh, good. Yeah, I mean, yeah. If you ever do like a concordance search on the third day, most of those are probably in the Old Testament about Jesus. Like, you're going to see that. Oh, those, thank you for that. Yes. Mordecai. How's Mordecai a shadow of Christ? Anybody have any thoughts about this? Actually, my question was, consider shadows of Christ as well as comparisons and contrasts with his character. So let me open that up a little more. Amy.
So I have a kind of combination one, but just reading a verse from Colossians just kind of put all this together in a really amazing way.
Okay.
This is Colossians chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. And I'm thinking about Mordecai and Haman and Esther getting the ring and just all that. So Colossians 2.
Yes.
Having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us, he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. Having disarmed principalities and powers, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it.
Yep. Which the book of Esther, that's just exactly how they get salvation. And you go, oh, wow, the old covenant, new covenant, and Jesus, and wow, yeah, that's exactly. It's what we've been talking about before. Lee?
Mordecai was dead for all intents and purposes, okay? But he ended up on top.
Yes.
Just like Jesus.
Right. Yes, good. I indicated this, that Mordecai honors the king and is rewarded for it at the hands of the enemy. Like, Haman had made this plot against Mordecai, and, hey, Haman, what should I do for the one who honors me? And it was all Haman's doing that got Mordecai honored. So just like Satan says, all right, how do I get at Jesus? How do I destroy the Son of God? And he figures out this way to bring him low. And then he shows up on the day, and all he does is send Jesus to the throne. I mean, to the cross, to the grave, but then ultimately to the throne. And that was, I mean, Satan's an idiot. I mean, that's what 1 Corinthians is saying, is his wisdom, the foolishness of God is greater than Satan's wisdom. And so him, Haman, Haman, defeated by God's provision. Okay? Noah.
Mordecai is a prophet, in a way. And I'm thinking using that term, prophet, and for speaking God's word. He just plainly tells, you know, Esther about what she needs to do and about the repercussions. That's kind of what the Lord does with us.
Okay.
You know,
yeah, might say he's a good teacher. He's not speaking forth from inspiration,
no,
which is what a prophet does.
Mainly.
And in that sense, yeah, I think he's a good teacher. Yeah. What about, yes, Nathan? Yeah, she's almost there at the, yes. So, from what I understand, Malachi is the last written prophet before you get the 400 years of science. And so, the time periods were Zerubbabel, Esther, Ezra, and Nehemiah. And it's during Nehemiah's day that Ezra and Nehemiah's day you're going to have Malachi prophesy. So, Esther comes just before that 400 years of science. So, we don't have any record of any written prophets during that 400 years. Am I answering your question? Talk with Mordecai? Oh, with Malachi. Yes. I'm sorry. I say Malachi, Malachi. Someone was saying Naphtali the other day. So God does speak with Malachi. Are you saying, does God tell Malachi there's going to be silence?
Do we see that interaction of God? I mean, we don't see much of God with Malachi and Esther, right?
I see. Yes. So, yeah, we're not going to see God interacting with people by prophets in that 400 years. Now, I will say this. When you get to the book of Luke, you get Anna the prophetess. So you got John the Baptist, you get Anna the prophetess. So I'm not going to say that there weren't prophets during that 400 years, but they're not revealing anything new. And they're certainly not writing anything down. So Anna and John the Baptist kind of seem to break that cycle for us, but it's curious you have Anna. But I'm not sure, maybe I'm missing the question, but you don't get any interaction ongoing in those 400 years. Thoughts about that idea?
It is interesting because God is not speaking here, but God does speak after Esther, but before the 400 years.
Yes, that's correct, yes. Yeah. It's Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah before Malachi does speak. So.
I know it's discombobulated, but the Maccabees, if you asked a Jewish person, they would tell you that there was a prophet.
It depends on who you ask, right? But that's good history. So if you read 1st, 2nd Maccabees, you're getting good history about the things that occurred during those years. But the Jews are going to be divided about whether that is scripture, word of God. You never see Jesus and the apostles quoting from that, that I know of. I may be wrong about that. But they certainly would have been familiar with
the pastors.
Okay. What about Haman? He's a bad guy. Yeah, I know he's a bad guy. But is he a shadow of Christ? Lynn?
I have for him that he is a shadow of Christ and that he takes the punishment that's intended for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what happens to Haman is what he intended to happen to them.
Okay. I think this is so good. Amy, go ahead.
Well, Haman does say to the king, there is a certain people, and I will pay.
Oh, that's good. I hadn't thought of it.
I didn't hear it.
She said that Haman goes to the king and says, there's a certain people, and they're a threat to your kingdom. I will pay.
Yeah, there's a certain people who are our enemies.
Right. Yeah, and of course, I will pay to exterminate, but Jesus says, I will pay to save. Yeah. So it is, I think, a shadow in that way. That's really neat. I like the idea of Haman being a shadow of Christ for this reason. Imagine being a Jew, and all your life you have celebrated Purim. And so who's the bad guy? Who are we celebrating destroying? Haman. And I don't know, like we put pictures up of different, like St. Patrick's Day, Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, turkeys on Thanksgiving. And so I imagine people are decorating their homes with pictures of, you know, here's Haman. And then you know, Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the Son of God. And you kind of got Purim back there somewhere, you just kind of forgotten it. And then one day, as a Jewish Christian, now, you believe Jesus of Nazareth, crucified on the cross, died for you. And you're getting ready for Purim, and you pull out... You pull out the image of Haman and you go, oh, that's what we did to Jesus. We treated him like our enemy. We treated him like the enemy of our people. And we're going to tell our children that God saved us by his death. I think that is such an unraveling sort of moment where it should have been me. It should have been me on the cross. Haman is impaled. Jesus was treated like the enemy. And so he is favored by the king, but he's rejected by the Jews. He is publicly hanged just outside his house in place of the man for which the execution was intended, satisfying the wrath of the king. And his estate is given to the king's bride. And she, in turn, gives it away. There's just really some neat connections here with Haman. And I will tell you, if you've not seen this before, some people are like, I don't know if I can accept Haman as that. It's okay. The point is Jesus, okay?
these things in the Old Testament are there to remind us of the power that I think sometimes we forget about in the crucifixion of Jesus. I think we get accustomed to the idea that Jesus died for me, Jesus died for me, but to realize that he's treated like the enemy when I deserve the death. That's a powerful image to me. Other thoughts, questions about Haman? David? I think perhaps you can see that full story and see both in a way. I appreciate what you said just there, is that Satan is defeated by the cross that he wanted to use to destroy others. I think that's well said.
I agree. He loses ego, crushes head. Mm-hmm. Same concept to me.
Yeah.
He wanted to get them.
Right.
And he got God.
Consider this too, some story points that further the shadow of Christ. This is something Amy mentioned before. A law by the king's authority condemns God's people to death. And then a last meal shared with the conspirator in which he's exposed. The law that kills is nullified by a new law and the death of the one who gave it. So just some really interesting connections between this story and the life of Christ and what he accomplishes. Okay, so I asked you to summarize the time period. How would you, just a couple minutes here, how would you summarize this return from captivity time period? Anybody have a couple of bullet points, Lynn?
The way I tried to describe it was, unless we are actively rebuilding and protecting the people of God, then we are going to crumble and die.
Yes. Yeah, we'll be overwhelmed by the enemy. Infighting will destroy us. Yes. We need someone to come and we're back and we're trying to do well, but boy, we're just kind of stuck in this ongoing cycle. We need someone to come and finish it. Other summaries for this time? It's a halfway hand. I'll halfway call
okay,
it.
Okay, so it's not what you're asking.
Go ahead.
Thinking more about Haman as an accuser.
Mm-hmm. Yes. By the blood of his.
Where you have the accuser of the brethren who accused them before God, they met him, now he's cast down. And part of the way they overcame him, they did not love their lives to death, which is Esther.
Yes. Yes. Good. And I think, you know, seeing Haman as Satan being destroyed, spot on, won't argue with that at all. The reason I picture Haman as a helpful picture of Christ is just the obvious, kind of like the 3 days thing. It's like, whenever you see 3 days, I mean, the man is on a cross. And so, like, okay, how does that connect to the story of Jesus? And to me, it helps me to see we treated Jesus like the enemy. We treated him like Haman. Obviously, Satan is destroyed. Satan's the enemy. But we treated Jesus like the enemy. And God treated him like his enemy in pouring his wrath out on him on the cross. Final question. Some instructions Christians should take from these books today. There's just a lot here, and I wish we had 10 more minutes to do this, but Lynn?
I basically answered that one with my first response.
Okay. People are just not playing well today. Thank you, Meredith, please.
well, like, reading these books, like, especially Esther, it's like very very satisfying book to read, like from a story perspective.
Yes.
Like it's lovely that they, like the irony and the things that like work out well for God's people when they obey Him. But like these aren't just stories. Like it shows God's plan.
Yes.
And then God's plan is good and right and true and it's fact
right.
from history. So
yes.
what we can learn from this is that when we obey God, He will be there for us.
Yeah.
And we need to obey Him. He wants us to obey Him. We cannot do it our own way,
yeah.
or else we will probably die.
Yes. If it's not a happy ending, then the story's not over yet. Life is a story. And so God has a happy ending in mind. And if things aren't where they ought to be yet, okay, the story's not done. And so I think it is helpful to see our lives kind of in view of that. Like, what would the story be when it's written down? Any other thought? Yeah, we need to get comfortable with being uncomfortable until he finishes it. Nathan?
So I really struggled with all these three books, so it was tough for me like, because there was no God coming into the book.
Right.
So that's the struggle. So I was really going through that book, and I totally believe God put the books in the Bible. So
yeah.
there's two things going on. So I was really thinking about it. So one thing I really got the picture of why what's happening is one thing is, even if I would recommend this book to someone to read, maybe some other books I would recommend. the problem is, what if it put self-centeredness over Christ-centeredness? Because it's more like you try to do, you discipline yourself through things,
yes.
and that's the kind of picture you might get.
Yeah.